Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
China threatens Hong Kong's autonomy. The University of California system drops the SAT. And Joe Biden's game of Veeps continues. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jugot. We are joined today by my colleagues, Bill McGurn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Kyle.
And Jason Willick. Happy Friday, Jason.
Good to be here.
Hong Kong has long been an outpost of freedom in China, and its autonomy was supposed to last for 50 years after the British handover in 1997. China has been trying to nibble away at that, and I take it that we don't have detailed specifics about Beijing's latest proposal. But Bill, I mean, many observers are saying that, I mean, could this be the end of one country, two systems?
If Beijing gets its way, it certainly will be. Look, what they've done now is they're making clear they're going to pass a national security law that would include provisions such as no disrespect for the Chinese anthem and so forth. This is very alien to the Hong Kong tradition. And before this, last summer, there was a provision that they were trying to get through that was fought, and that was for extradition, because people in Hong Kong feared, I'm going to be arrested in Hong Kong for something and end up in China, and no one wants that. So what this latest move is, it is a huge move, because they've taken some questionably legal maneuvers to get here. But it's part of a 20-year operation to get something like this through. They want absolute power over Hong Kong. They don't care how much it costs the Hong Kong people, the Hong Kong economy, and they're going to do it. Look, a reasonable person, now that the protests from last year have died down, would say, okay, let's see if we can work out some accommodation, let feelings cool. But they've escalated, and they're probably going to get their way.
So, Bill, what do you think are the immediate consequences, though? I mean, it seems likely to reignite those protests. But what about an exodus of people and capital from Hong Kong? And do you think either of those could be powerful enough to change anybody's mind in Beijing?
Yeah, let me answer the last question first. No, because I think they've taken these are all absolutely obvious things, as you mentioned, reigniting protests, the harm to the economy. I think they said we're willing to pay that price to make sure that they know in Hong Kong that we're the boss. So that's the real problem that we're up against. And we don't have too many tools that would discourage the Chinese from doing this. We're not going to, you know, land the fleet there. So short of that, there's not that much we can do. We can complain. We can probably sanction some people for things, but I'm not sure we have anything strong enough to dissuade the government in Beijing from doing what it's doing.
On the point about economic damage, I mean, part of the story may be just that Hong Kong is not as large of a fraction of the economy as it used to be. But on sanctions, I mean, there are some senators, including Pat Toomey, who are saying that they'll offer legislation to put sanctions on Chinese officials who enforce any of these new rules on Hong Kong. President Trump, Jason, on Thursday said that, here's his quote, if it happens, we'll address that issue very strongly. So, I mean, even if you doubt the ability to change Beijing's mind here, what is in the America's toolbox?
Well, I think the flouting of the Sino-British Joint Declaration, which is basically what Beijing's doing by usurping Hong Kong's autonomy before the 50 years are up, sort of goes to the heart of some of President Trump's complaints about China, which is they haven't been honest. They weren't honest about trade. They haven't been honest about the coronavirus. And here's a clear example of them flouting an international agreement. So I think it gives him more ammunition to argue about those issues that he's historically have been more close to him than the Hong Kong issue.
Well, what about just some specifics, Bill? So one that's kind of been in the mix for a while is Congress passed a law last year telling the State Department essentially to examine whether Hong Kong is still sufficiently autonomous to justify the special treatment that it gets under U.S. law. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said that he's delaying the report, so we don't know immediately what the answer, but these new security laws would certainly weigh on the no side of the ledger, you know, possibly raising the question of whether the United States could come to treat Hong Kong just like it does the rest of China.
Right. I'm very ambivalent on that act for this reason. The logic is impeccable. If Hong Kong is no longer distinct from China in how it treats foreigners, how it treats itself, if it's not really a distinct entity as promised under the Joint Declaration, then why should we give it any advantages? So the logic is impeccable. The problem with that is that the tool, the enforcement here, is sanctions, which would on Hong Kong, which would affect Hong Kong. It would mean raising the tariffs and so forth to China levels. And I'm not sure that achieves what we want to achieve, because it seems to punish Hong Kong more than China. I would say, if we have to look at this, I mean, Jason mentioned some of the other violations, you know, they cheated everything, all international agreements. I think we have to step back and look at the totality of our relationship with China on this. And Hong Kong is an example. And to me, the priority is how do we contain this growing beast in Beijing? You know, the human rights violations are appalling, whether it's the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, the Christians, or the Hong Kong people. And again, I don't think there's much we can do that would get them to change course, because they're willing to have Hong Kong burned to the ground so long as everyone knows their boss. But we could do things like strengthen Taiwan. I think Taiwan is watching this. You know, Beijing is complaining that falsely that the Hong Kong people want independence. That's not what they've been asking. But I think this increases the mood and appetite for independence in a place like Beijing, like Taipei. And one of the things we have to do is help Taiwan stay independent and be able to protect itself. Other things we could do to increase pressure on China. I know Donald Trump didn't like it because it was multilateral, but the TPP trade agreement, you know, that would unite a lot of other people in the region with us would be another vehicle for doing this. I think we have to look at building an architecture to get China to behave itself. And unfortunately, in the short term, I really don't see a lot of hope for persuading them otherwise on Hong Kong.
Well, what about the issue of Taiwan, Jason? I mean, the United States sells weapons to Taiwan, but still maintains the sort of polite fiction of one country, two systems, and does not have formal diplomatic relations. is you know, taking a more intense diplomatic relationship with Taiwan something that could be useful here, or would that sort of escalate the situation, do you think?
I think that could definitely be useful. Like you said, sort of the U.S. language around Taiwan and China is, you know, we want both parties to you know, come to mutually agreed upon terms. We paint ourselves as sort of a neutral arbiter. Meanwhile, Taiwan has been this sort of outstanding ally for many decades. And, you know, there's all sorts of things we can't do because we don't officially recognize them militarily, diplomatically. And I think that, you know, the question Bill talked about, how do you impose costs? I think that's one concrete way where you could actually have some leverage against Beijing.
All right, hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. What about one more specific idea, Bill, that you hear thrown around sometimes, which is this idea of barring, you know, maybe the children of Chinese officials from studying at American universities, or maybe barring Chinese students altogether? I mean, you can see how that could exert some pressure, but you can also see another side of the argument that, you know, maybe some of those people that come here are really talented and stay here and contribute to, you know, science and progress here, and, you know, maybe are able to send a little bit of democratic values home.
Yeah, I'm partial to doing something, especially for children of party members. I mean, there's more than 200,000 Chinese students here. So I'm partial to that, partly because I think it would have put some pressure on Xi. I mean, if you're a Chinese parent and your kid's going off to Yale or Dartmouth or the University of Washington, and then all of a sudden you can't go because of the government, it would put a lot of pressure, I think, on them. The problem is everything has its cost. The advantage of the students is I think it inflicts the least harm on the economy as opposed to tariffs and so forth. But, you know, China would likely respond by saying none of our kids can go to school in America. I think that's what President Xi would prefer, and kicking out all the American students. So everything has its cost. And again, going back to the initial problem, even if there are costs imposed, I think China's decided that we can ride out whatever the costs are, even if it's trashing Hong Kong and so forth. And I don't see anything that's going to get them to reconsider this. What I see is we should build an architecture to deal with China as it's growing, help Taiwan. The other thing, Jason sort of alluded to it, but didn't spell it out. But in addition to sort of punishing China for these actions, I think we can encourage other folks, the good actors in the region. Like we could expand, we could say 25,000 more college visas for Hong Kong students. How about maybe another 25,000 for Taiwanese students? So there are a lot of carrots we could give out too to the other people. And I think that would China might get the message from there. Primarily, I think the priority has to be to make sure that Taiwan doesn't go through the same experience a few years down the road.
Yeah, and I wonder if this is an interesting moment for some of these ideas to get traction in ways that they've not been able to before. I mean, it does seem like there is growing bipartisan agreement about the threat that China poses. And this week, Jason, the White House issued a report about the U.S. strategic approach. What is the gist of that report?
The gist of that report is basically that the U.S. has treated China for decades as sort of an aspiring stakeholder in the community of nations, and now we recognize that that didn't work out. It's a sort of totalitarian regime at home, exporting its values abroad, mercantilistic, imperialistic, and we're going to look at China differently. It uses the word fundamental reevaluation and says we're going to have an approach of great power competition with China. It doesn't say we're going to have a cold war with China, that we're in sort of an existential fight to the death, but it says we're going to be competing, and it outlines the various ways we're going to compete and what interests we're going to try to protect.
Yeah, I'll read just a quote from the beginning. It says, quote, "Since the United States and the People's Republic of China established diplomatic relations in 1979, United States policy toward the PRC was largely premised on a hope that deepening engagement would spur fundamental economic and political opening in the PRC, lead to its emergence as a constructive and responsible global stakeholder," unquote. I mean, Bill, that hasn't happened yet, but that still, is there any hope for that yet, do you think?
Kyle, I was one of the people who believed that. I was living in Hong Kong, and I watched the dictatorship in South Korea democratize. I watched the same thing in Taiwan. Again, China's different. It's totalitarian, and it hasn't worked out the way those of us, who had some faith in that wanted to. I think it hasn't been a total failure. China was very poor, and the people are eating better and living better than they did before. And we shouldn't discount that. I mean, we couldn't have a policy designed to just keep China poor. It wouldn't have worked, and it wouldn't have been right. But I think the key now, and I think that this is what Secretary Pompeo is hammering at, is China is cheating. Hong Kong's only one part of the Chinese cheating and lying and failure to live up to its obligations all across the world, just to name one. In the WTO, I mean, China's admitted as a developing nation, so it had lesser rules, and it's even violating that. I think the key now has to be, we have to hold China to its obligations to the degree that we can, and instead of giving them a pass on so many things.
All right, switching gears a little bit. On Thursday, the regents of the University of California system voted unanimously to phase out the use of the SAT and the ACT college entrance tests. And Jason, that's being presented, at least they're presenting it, as a victory for equity.
That's right. there's an idea that the SAT and the ACT, that standardized tests are discriminatory against minorities. The UC actually commissioned a faculty senate committee to study this and look at probably one of the most detailed looks at the data on the SAT ever, because they had the data available of tens of thousands of UC students, and they found there was no discrimination, there wasn't bias. The biggest obstacles for minority students to get in were mostly due to, you know, completion of courses, poor school districts, and so on. But nonetheless, this idea took hold, and the sort of regents are patting themselves on the back for advancing equity when there's no evidence that's what they're doing. And in fact, in my view, it's more likely the opposite, because this test was actually a way to find people who didn't come from privileged backgrounds who might have a good performance and a good chance of succeeding.
Yeah, that was the quote from the reporting on this faculty task force study that really stood out to me. So here's a quote from that report. It says, quote, "The original intent of the SAT was to identify students who came from outside relatively privileged circles who might have the potential to succeed in university. This original intent is clearly being realized at UC." Unquote. And the alternative without a test, it seems to me, Bill, is if there's no objective measure of student aptitude, even if it's imperfect, if you give up on the idea of that totally, it sort of just muddies the waters. Admissions departments have a free hand to do whatever they want and to not be questioned about it. I mean, Harvard has been sued for allegedly discriminating against Asian Americans. And part of that argument is that they have those applicants have better overall test scores. But if you don't have test scores from everybody on file on record, it makes it harder to make the argument that the admissions process is unfair or rigged.
Yes, I say bingo, Kyle, because when you make a system more subjective, I mean, college admissions is already a very murky process for most students and parents to go through. You make these subjective considerations, you know, more powerful. And I think actually give advantage to the people that they're trying to take the advantage from, wealthier people that have contacts. You know, you look at the Varsity Blues scandal, how they exploited the wealthy people were able to exploit different loopholes and so forth with athletes. Now, they cheated at some of it, but it just opens the door to that kind of thing when you don't have an objective system. You know, it used to be a lot of people thought, per your example before, that objective tests, for example, ended discrimination against Jewish students who did very well but were kept out because of all other subjective considerations. This gave them a path in on merit. So there's a lot of arguments here. You know, one is whether the SATs are a good indicator of college performance. There's some debate over that. The College Board itself says that the best indicator is grades plus their entrance test. Again, the argument here seems to be equity, but it's just interesting that the answer is to throw out a test rather than, say, give kids in these crummy schools that are applying, give them an option to go to a good school, you know, charter school, parochial school, or start having the state offer some college prep courses itself to help give these kids the same chance that the wealthier kids have. Instead, we're just saying, let's eliminate the standard because we don't like the outcome.
Well, the UC Faculty Task Force report, I think they took a stand on whether it predicted success.
Right.
And yes. So it's interesting that the UC is sort of overruling its own faculty expert advice there. But Jason, I wonder, I mean, the UC system is huge. There's a lot of students, a lot of professors, a lot of administrators there. And I wonder whether there are other schools around the country that may be looking at this and taking their cues from this. I mean, I know, I believe the University of Chicago has gone to test optional for applicants. Are there other schools that are, you know, maybe following suit here or at least considering it?
There's a lot of schools that have gone test optional, as you said, but going test optional is somewhat of a different beast, because some schools kind of do that so that, you know, only kids with better scores will then submit their scores, but they're still using it for the vast majority. I think with Chicago, they said 85 to 90% had still submitted scores. What the UC is saying is they're saying we're optional next year, and then we're basically done. You know, we're eliminating, we won't consider it even if you submit it. So I don't, just because I think schools find it an important tool for their value proposition, they're saying, you know, we want to let people in who are likely to graduate and likely to succeed. And this is an important tool for them to help discern that. And so they'd have to be very sort of politically motivated and under a lot of political pressure like the UC in order to go all the way. I doubt that other schools will follow all the way, but who knows?
All right. And then one last thing, the public tryout to be Joe Biden's running mate continues. And the latest news is that Amy Klobuchar, the Minnesota senator, is reportedly going through some formal vetting. Bill, how do you think that she stacks up in terms of the possible picks?
I think she stacks up well. Look, one of the dilemmas they have, the choice they have to make, are we going to get someone that's really going to solidify the left and get them out there? Or are we going to get someone that's more traditionally in the, you know, the Democratic middle that might appeal to the Midwest, you know, where there are a lot of battleground states? And I think that Amy Klobuchar probably fits that latter bill pretty well, especially if Joe Biden is comfortable that he's going to do well with African-American support. It might make sense to kind of shore up that middle. Look, it also in the contest against Donald Trump, I think the vice president has made some mistakes in that he seems to be opting to out-Trump Trump, which I don't think he can do. I don't think it's possible. I think it's led to a bunch of gaffes. I think what he wants to do is say, I offer something really different, a return to civility, reasonableness and so forth. I think that's what Amy Klobuchar might do. I think she did pretty well in the debates in the sense of she may not have carried all the arguments, but I think she carried herself well, was pretty forceful, and actually would fit in comfortably with the Biden administration.
Yeah, that may be true, though. I suspect that the progressive wing of the party would be pretty upset at that choice. And it's interesting to see some of the other maneuvering here. So Elizabeth Warren is a good example. She spent the whole campaign basically talking about and then defending Medicare for all. And this week, she was talking to some students at the University of Chicago. And here's a quote from her. She said, quote, "I think right now people want to see improvements in our healthcare system. And that means strengthening the Affordable Care Act," unquote. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but to me, that looks like a clear attempt to align herself, Jason, with the Joe Biden agenda here.
I think everyone's doing Joe's Veep stakes in part because Joe Biden is unlikely to serve two terms. He even said he was even considering or purported to be considering making a one-term pledge at one point. So I think whoever is the vice president in a Joe Biden administration is automatically the front runner. And I think that's part of what's driving a lot of the interest. And I think, you know, just on the point of, is it better to pick the left or to pick sort of traditional Democrats? I mean, not that anyone cares about my advice, but it seems to me if Biden is leading in the polls, why make a risky pick? If he's, you know, so far ahead in the polls, pick somebody non-threatening, don't sort of create new lines of attack. And that would seem to me to be the wiser course.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable point. Do no harm, even if you end up picking somebody who is bland and is not adding much to the ticket. Not that that applies to anyone specific that I'm talking about. No offense to Ms. Klobuchar. But Bill, do you buy that argument?
Yeah, look, I think the progressives are going to be very mad. I think, this is a problem he has to deal with. Bernie Sanders is keeping his delegates. He wants a lot of say over the, over the final platform. The question is, how many costs does Bernie Sanders impose on Joe Biden? Joe Biden has moved a long way in the progressive direction, and Bernie Sanders didn't move an inch from his positions on this. And can Joe Biden really campaign as a reasonable alternative if he's going to embrace the entire progressive agenda?
Well, we may find out here shortly, but thank you, Bill and Jason. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.